The hugely influential Canadian sketch comedy troupe, The Kids in the Hall, is back. While the five members have come together for various projects over the years, the new Amazon show marks their first return to writing and performing original sketches on television. These eight episodes look and feel like another season of the original Kids in the Hall show, though of course the kids aren't kids anymore, something the new series has some fun with. I'm Glenn Weldon, and today we're talking about The Kids in the Hall on Pop Culture Happy Hour from NPR. Joining me today is Daisy Rosario. She's a podcast producer and storyteller who you may have heard on a little thing called the Moth Radio Hour. Hey, Daisy.
Hey, Glenn.
So let's get into this. I think we're both fans, so this will be fun. The Kids in the Hall consists of Dave Foley, Mark McKinney, Kevin MacDonald, Bruce McCullough, and Scott Thompson. Their original series ran for five seasons from 1989 to 1995. It aired on the CBC in Canada and on HBO and CBS in the States, and then lived on in reruns on Comedy Central. They were first championed by Saturday Night Live's Lorne Michaels, though the kids always felt distinct from SNL. They were weirder, artsier, more conceptual, and considerably queerer, and they still are. Whenever they portray women for a sketch, their drag isn't the joke in and of itself, as it is in Monty Python. It's a means to create a character. They were never immune to the SNL fetish for recurring sketch characters with catchphrases, the chicken lady, the head crusher, cabbage head, but they always used them relatively sparingly and knowingly. Most of the kids are in their early 60s now, and the new show doubles down on that truth. There are plenty of callbacks to old characters and to the failure of the Kids in the Hall's 1996 movie Brain Candy, but most of this new series consists of new material that seeks to stand on its own. It is streaming now on Amazon Prime, and we should note that Amazon is among NPR's financial supporters and also distributes NPR content. Daisy, what do you make of the new Kids in the Hall?
Oh my gosh, I have to admit, I was a little nervous. I was nervous, right?
I mean,
how many reboots, if you will, have worked out? You know, there are a lot of things lately that I'm like, let us just remember you better. And this was such a treat.
Yeah.
I ended up loving it. It did take a little while to get started for me. And I'm sure we'll get into some of that detail. But even early on, even when I was kind of like, I don't know how this is going to go, it still feels like them. And then there was, you know, it just felt like there was a moment where they fully ripped the Band-Aid off and just went for it and were completely them. And it was just the loveliest feeling. It was so great to watch it. The way you describe them is totally right. They've always been a little weirder, a little more absurd, a lot queerer. And none of that has gone away, even as the world has shifted in a lot of ways. So it just was so fun. And it also didn't feel like it was trying to be overly topical. That was never what they did.
Right.
So, you know, it felt very true to them. And that just made me so happy.
I'm trying to unpack exactly why this works and so many other things, like you mentioned, don't. I mean, I was just as worried as you were, if not more. I mean, I love this troupe as a college student, as a grad student. I was taping them off of HBO. They were kind of the voice of Gen X.
Mm-hmm.
And I watched those VHS tapes I made again and again and again. Yet I didn't want to go see them when they toured because I didn't want to see recycled material. I didn't watch Death Comes to Town, which is their thing that aired on IFC here, which was kind of a mystery series, non-sketch series that they did. I don't know why I didn't see it. I think it just didn't register for me.
I think at the time I didn't have IFC and I never quite got around to it myself either.
But they nailed it in so many ways. Structurally, of course, it is seamless. The first chords from the Shadowy Men on a Shadowy Planet theme kick in and I get choked up.
Oh yeah.
That kind of I love the 80s, you know, sketchy font that kind of vibrates on the screen.
Yeah.
And then Amazon comes to you like, skip intro? And I'm like, how dare you? Of course not. No, I'm not.
I will never skip that intro. Like, you just play it.
But you know what I really miss, though, Daisy, is the live component.
Mm.
These are all filmed sketches. But if they get a season two, man, that definitely needs to come back because that is the only way that monologues work on this show. And monologues was such a huge part of the DNA of the Kids in the Hall. Not just the Buddy Call monologues, but of course the Buddy Call monologues. But like Kevin MacDonald's Daddy Drank and The Bass Player and Dave Foley's bad doctor and good attitude toward menstruation and Bruce McCulloch's open letter to the guy who stole his bicycle wheel and Mark McKinney's infected toe. I love the interplay between these guys, right? But I also love those moments when they just kind of be able to step forward, get the spotlight, because you knew you were getting this guy's sensibility. This guy wrote this.
Yes.
And look, as you mentioned, this should not work. It has been almost 30 years.
Yeah.
But, you know, apart from them all looking more like my dad than they ever did, you know, this does seem like Kids in the Hall season 6. So what are they doing right?
I sometimes wonder, you know, with some of these reboots and revisits in general, something that I have always found very interesting, and especially as someone who pursued comedy myself and has always loved the things that were like a little more out there, a little more weird. So many creative people, when they're pursuing that career, make really interesting stuff because they have to. They're scrappy. They're out there. They got to get people to know who they are. And then as they actually reach that level of success, you know, sometimes they do great work, but a lot of the time the work becomes, you know, a little more stagnant, a little more mainstream. Mm-hmm. And I feel like what part of what works about this is while these guys have had all of this other success and they've done these other things, they seem very aware that there is something special that happens to them when they are together as a group, that they are not five people that are exactly the same, that they're five weirdos who bring out great weirdness in each other. And it felt to me like they were really letting themselves just do that, to go like, okay, we're not here because you may have seen Mark McKinney on Superstore and now you're interested. Like, we are going to be the group that we are when we're together. And I think really giving into that and not trying to, you know, appease other people is a lot of what works about this for me. And the one thing that doesn't work for me is, you know, they have these little interstitials where they kind of bring in a celebrity that's supposed to be a Kids in the Hall, like friend or fan. And I did end up reading some other reviews, and it's kind of like the main thing that a lot of people don't think works, in part because it just doesn't feel like the DNA of them. Having a celebrity around was not the draw for them. It's kind of their own weird chemistry, and let it be what it was instead of trying to make a thing that would live up to someone's idea of them.
I get what they were trying to do with those interstitials. They're trying to gesture towards the influence that the show has had. So look, you know, and you get all these other people who are younger in most cases, and they have something to say about the show, but by not saying something about how much it influenced them, by just doing a bit that is supposed to kind of factor into the show somehow. But these guys have aged, but they've aged physically, not necessarily retreated politically. And part of that is the Canadian thing. But the other thing is that this was always a different kind of show. Progressivism, queerness, a pitched empathy for the outsider was always baked in from the beginning. It was never a pose that they assumed. It was always the sensibility. It was always how they approach things. So that old sketch from the original series where they play fur trappers who hunt businessmen in Toronto and sell their suits as pelts.
Friend, so what have you brought me today?
We have some Fendi and some Perry Ellis and, of course, Hugo Boss and, of course, many, many Armani.
Fresh.
Yesterday's guild.
All those AT and Love sketches kind of making fun of corporate culture, that isn't by any means a nuanced take on, you know, whatever, late stage capitalism. But I equate it to what Mad Magazine was doing for generations before them, which is to say it instills in viewers a sense of skepticism. And I don't want to get into it. Punches up, it punches down. But it does punch, right? There, it's not a rage, really, anger. It's dissatisfaction, I guess.
Yes, absolutely. The world is in and of itself really odd and funny. And so much of their humor always came from the details of people, the interactions, their own traumas growing up, which of course they have, you know, more language for now, but then we're just kind of acting some of those things out, like the idea, you know, some of the drunk dad sketches and things like that. And I feel like that is part of what was very special about them, even at the time. Like, again, you know, they weren't trying to be topical. They were just making fun of the absurdity of life in so many ways. You know, they stuck to the authenticity of that in them. They didn't lose that as they went, which I think is rare as well. And I think specifically, they also always were very like anti-authoritarian, anti-capitalist in that way that like Gen X gets painted as such.
Sure.
I am not Gen X, but I was watching this show when I was like literally like nine. I was like very sickly kid who was just home from school a lot and up late and always watching the thing. Like my mom had no idea what I was watching because I was just not going to school the next day. I was on the sofa. So I loved this show, and the only other people who loved this show were like 20 somethings, and I didn't know 20 somethings when I was nine. And but you know, it's like I'm sitting at home watching The Kids in the Hall, and this is the same era where I'm watching that first season of The Real World. I'm seeing all this queerness and like questioning of what has to be. And then over the next, you know, 10, 15 years, we talk about as a society that there is not the idea of like selling out anymore. And yeah, these guys are very just clearly of that generation where it's like, you could argue that they did in various ways or, but that doesn't seem like that's just even how they think of it. They're making their own stuff. And this is this really fun culmination of that. And so to see that they didn't lose that outsider perspective and all of that is really special. It just felt so fresh. And people always make the argument that like you get older and you just naturally get more conservative. And it's like, I think you get older and you just get to be more of what you are to a degree. And that's very much how this feels. Like they're still bananas people. They're so fun. And it was amazing to me how much it does feel like season six and not the reboot.
There is a timelessness here, and I think you keyed into it because they're not doing parodies. And in an interview on Jesse David Fox's Vulture podcast, Good One, they explained why, which is they say they're not doing parodies out of respect for SNL, who do it better than we ever could. I suspect they're being polite there. But also that parody has a very short shelf life. So they are looking toward this stuff being timeless, right? And as much as I love SCTV, that was fueled by TV parodies of the time. And if I were to try to show that to someone today, it would be like trying to translate it from the Sanskrit, because it's all about the rhythms and the sensibility of TV at that very specific time. So they're doing satire, but they're also doing, as you mentioned, they're doing silly. They're doing this smart but dumb thing, which is now pervasive in comedy, the so-called alt comedy. And also they're doing weird, you know, there's still some holdovers from like, I've lost my Indian drum and I had the pear dream again. And I can't stop thinking about Tony, wondering where he could be, who he is with, what he's thinking. Is he thinking of me and whether he'll ever return someday? Mm-hmm. If any, I think maybe the sketch Amber Blantz might get up there in the Hall of Fame, but I don't know.
I've got a kid on the line. Says his pop-pop fell and he's scared. Wants an Amber Blantz.
Amber Blantz?
Amber Blantz.
I better check the book.
Yeah.
Now, have you seen the two-part kids documentary that Amazon released at the same time they released these called Comedy Punks?
Yes, I did watch the documentary.
What'd you think of it?
I mean, it was fun to watch in the sense that, you know, it was great to get the context and that vibe that they were having in Toronto and, you know, kind of being in this little theater on this one little street and how much of a playground that was for them and allowed them to get good at what they were doing. I mean, all of that was just really fun to see. And also, as well, the mature perspective of these guys being able to look back and look at the times that they weren't getting along and the things that were hard for them with early success as they are trying to make a living kind of post-series and things like that. So, you know, it was great. And it's great to see them really like each other while being really honest about the ways that they were not good to each other in the past. It was just really lovely. It left me with a really nice feeling.
Well, that's it. I completely agree. I recommend it highly because you do get to see so much early footage of them when they're performing at the Rivoli Theater in Toronto. You get them to talk very candidly about how competitive and at sometimes combative their creative dynamic remains.
Yeah.
They are, you know, 60-some-year-old adults, most of them, and they're looking back on that time with a tremendous amount of deeply earned and sincere affection for each other. They are unique people to each other because only they have gone through this thing.
I was watching it so young, and I had no older siblings. So I had no context for where it fit into the world. I had no context for it being a weird thing. It was just this thing that was on late. So for me, it was like, oh, when you are an adult, like, you can still just be wacky.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, I definitely have outlets for these things now that I didn't have that is part of what made it so special. So it probably won't be something I rewatch 70 times the way that it was. And there are people in that documentary that came up similar timeline as me in certain ways. And I'm watching it and I'm thinking, okay, but when I got to the comedy scene, like, I was expecting all the weird. And it was what I ran into a lot, really, were like straight white men with a lot of privilege who were mad that they didn't have more of it, which was not the vibe of Kids in the Hall. And so do I need it as much in my life overall? Like, no. But I think, like, timing-wise, this is a great, great, great time to be reminded of it. Because even watching the documentary and them, you know, talking about their time at the Rivoli, and, you know, one of them makes reference to, like, the 10,000 hours that we got to do. I mean, we're coming out of a period of a few years where it's like, it's not like it's been easy to get together with a group of people in a room and be creative together. There are obviously many digital ways that we can do it, but there is so much to be said for just getting to play and learn and grow with each other. And they just have such strong roots in that. So it's like really lovely to see kind of a mature reminder of all of those things when it doesn't feel like the world is necessarily enabling that kind of connection, if you will.
Yep. And before we started taping, you mentioned that this has inspired you to go back to the original series. I think it's going to inspire me to go back to the original series for a 118th time, I suppose. But yeah, two thumbs up for the new Kids in the Hall and the old. We want to know what you think about the Kids in the Hall. Find us at facebook.com/PCHH and on Twitter at PCHH. That brings us to the end of our show. Daisy Rosario, you're perfect. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Glenn. This was so fun.
And of course, thank you for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour from NPR. This episode was produced by Mike Katziff and edited by Jessica Reedy. And Hello Come In provides the music you may or may not be bobbing your head to right now. I'm Glenn Weldon, and we will see you all tomorrow, when we will be talking about the new album from Harry Styles.